The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am here with the wine steward, the head somm of Midfield Wine Bar, Annette Christine Brulé, or ACB, as she's called by nobody. Annette, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
And we are here on Dundas West at one of the best wine bars in Toronto. I think you'd agree. I mean,
I have to agree. Yeah. My boss is going to listen to this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. First question for you. What is the best wine to pair with Pizza Hut pizza?
Oh, Pizza Hut pizza?
Pizza Hut, specifically Pizza Hut. Because isn't that where you got started working at Pizza Hut in Thunder Bay?
I did, but I wasn't really drinking wine back then. I was a beer drinker.
Yeah.
Which is still a great pairing with Pizza Hut. Pizza Hut pizza is fried bread
with
a lot of greasy toppings on it.
Yeah, so what wine would you throw with that?
But I'm going to go with just like a mainstay for any kind of pizza, but it actually would be excellent with Pizza Hut pizza is anything that's a dry, sparkling red.
Okay.
So it could be like the red Lambruscos, like Rasparosas, or it could be we have a red, dry sparkling red right now in-house that's made in the Prosecco, the Charmat method.
Yep.
Which is just really clean. We also have like a Mine Clang, like a pet, pet nats, but as long as they're red and they're dry and they're bubbly, because it just cuts everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I could say the same about like Prosecco's great with pizza, but I love red, the red varietals.
I like it. I mean, that's the first time I've heard that answer with pizza. But I wanted to start with Pizza Hut because I want to talk to you just about the wine philosophy here, but also I want to talk about your journey. So how did you go from, working at, from Thunder Bay? Well, let's start this. Thunder Bay, growing up, what was the wine scene like?
It's funny because it is.
Yeah.
Wine scene there. So I want to say there's a lot of, in Thunder Bay, there's a lot of Italians and there's a lot of Finns, a lot of Scandinavian people. And there's a lot of beer there.
Yeah.
But the Italians, if they were drinking wine, were drinking like old school, possibly like old school Chianti, or like one of my uncles would make wine and his basement or garage or something, and they would come out at the family parties in the little tiny water glasses, like those little table glasses. That's what the wine went in. It was awful. It was awful, and it was always so tannic and acidic, and I thought it would like your mouth. It was an assault on your mouth and all of your senses, and it felt like it was stripping your teeth and just the enamel off of your teeth. It was bad. I love him very much. He's passed away. My Uncle George. But that was like my memory of wine. And then whatever my parents were keeping in their liquor cabinet. And they weren't big wine drinkers either. There was a box wine somewhere in there. And that would be at big gatherings in Thunder Bay. It was probably box wine. My parents also opened bottles of wine and then left them open, like kept them open. And we'll pull them out for guests, but I'm sure those bottles had been sitting there for months and months.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no. It was like Hochtaler and Blue Nun. And I feel like this story is like common for a lot of us that grew up in smaller towns or families that weren't like very European. Because I had friends that were drinking, if their family was from Italy and they were the first generation born here, they grew up with like some wine at the table. And I'm 100% sure it was never as bad as what I experienced in Thunder Bay.
And what I find interesting, and you're right, I've interviewed a bunch of people that came from smaller towns, and wine, it's either it was a big part with the family or nothing at all.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting, your journey, because you start, Thunder Bay, beer, your uncle's bad wine, and bottles of wine that have been open for ages, and now you're heading, one of the best wine bars in the city. You worked on cruise ships for a while before you really got into the Toronto restaurant scene. Yeah. When you departed on your last day of working on a cruise ship, what was your wine level? What was your wine knowledge at that point?
I actually had started to drink more wine on the cruise ship, but it was not. I think I had like a little taste of wine before I'd started working on cruise ships, and through a friend of mine who loved wine. She married a French guy. They always had wine at home. Their wine selection was decent, and I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. Mm-hmm. But while I was working on cruise ships, again, there was a lot of beer and a lot of spirits and one red, one white kind of thing. But then when you go into port, you'd look for a liquor store. And I always remember, I think Yellowtail started to become, I think it was when they had just started
early
doing major releases,
like early
in North America.
Kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, Yellowtail, red, whatever it was. If it was, I don't know if it was Syrah or Cabernet Sauvignon or something, but my roommate and I started drinking that.
Yeah.
And we thought that was okay.
Yeah, well.
Because it's like sweet and easy. And
but that's the funny thing is like, I think a lot of people work in wine. They have both a love and a hate for shitty wine.
Yeah.
Because shitty wine is where a lot of people start. And just because when you're younger, you don't know better. When you're young, you're not going to know, oh, well, I'm going to get the second wine from Margaux because it's a great value. You know, you start with that, and that's your sort of your building blocks. It's bad.
Wolf Blast was another one, I think. Wolf Blast was like,
well,
if I went
fancy
to the K,
stuff. That was the Saturday night was Wolf Blast. Thursday night was Yellowtail. Yeah.
It's all, and they had like all the similar, I'm not going to, well, it's not like they'll ever hear this, but the Wolf Blast versus Yellowtail, there's a similarity in what they're trying to do in order to reach a general crowd of average wine drinkers kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's just appealing. And
higher alcohol, higher sugar.
It's not overly complex. But that was my out of the gate. But like you were saying, it's a place to start.
Yeah.
And then when you start drinking more and more wine, you have some kind of foundation to work with, and you grow from there. So
you know what Yellowtail?
Thank you, Yellowtail and Wolf Blast.
You know what Yellowtail is? Yellowtail really is your first relationship. You had them when they were young. You didn't know what you were doing. You fumbled around a lot. Yeah. Eventually, you know, you're not going to be with them forever. But you look back fondly, and you don't remember the bad times. You remember the good times.
Maybe that's what Wolf Blast was to me. Yeah. That might have actually been my first relationship.
Yeah.
I'm only half joking.
We'll get this later. We'll lie you down on the couch, and you know, tell me about your father and
dear
your
Dr.
relationship.
Matt.
Yeah, exactly. I want to flip ahead to 2008. I love the Jamie Kennedy Wine Bar.
Yeah,
is one of the, like, I love that place. I was so passionate.
So do I.
And when he left, but the bar was still there, I'm like, I was like, okay, well, it's still, you know, it's still providing a lot of what it was, and then it went away. It had a big impact on my life. I'm just curious for you, what was it like? What were your experiences working at such an iconic bar?
It was the best restaurant experience I've had so far, and I got so lucky because it was when I was working on cruise ships, that's when I realized I wanted to be in hospitality.
Yeah.
And I kind of had, I think a lot of us do this, we think about, we're like, we want our own bar, we want our own restaurant, or these dreams of having ownership and doing things our own way. And that, I kind of had that when I got off cruise ships. And Jamie Kennedy Wine Bar was the first place I got a job. I remember my interview. I was going in from for a hostess interview, and I was interviewed by three different people all at once. It was like, you know, like the kind of like me on one side of the table
and then three
of them
other
on
people?
The other side, and I was like, oh, this is a hostess job. And it, for me, getting a job like that at my age then,
how old
it
are you?
Was when it was, so it was 2008, I was 38. 38, is that right?
I don't know. Don't I
think so.
Wouldn't it be weird if I said no, actually it was 37. No, I remember
like,
that day.
Dad. I was there stalking you. I was 38, and so
what were the questions?
For me, it was a lot of it was focused on working with a team. And that's what they were. They were a really well-managed team there. And really respectful of their employees, and they encouraged that front of house, back of house relationship, trying to keep it cohesive and having everybody respect everybody else's roles. And so to them, the hostess job, I was just like, oh, I'm just going to be a hostess. Like I was back in, I started out doing hostess work at Pizza Hut before I was a server there. But it's not the same job.
Little bit different. I will say I thought Pizza Hut had a much better Alsatian white selection than Jamie Kennedy is. But beyond that, you know, I give the wine to Jamie.
But they cultivated a great energy in that place, and they made you want to work hard for them. And then just like everything that I learned about them in a very short time really resonated with me about what they were trying to achieve, and that whole Jamie and slow food and local, sustainable, and supporting your suppliers, and buying product that if you buy good product, you don't have to screw around with the dishes very much. You have to just respect that product and highlight it, and,
yeah,
which takes skill as a chef. And then Jamie Drummond was huge influence, that was... It was so funny to me to start there, because they're like, no, you have to take wine training with the rest of the staff. And I'm thinking,
oh, that's great.
All right, great.
But that makes total sense. I mean, then, yep, you know, the whole place is surrounded by wine knowledge.
Yeah. And his approach was to always, it's like everybody's opinion matters, and there's right and wrong, but when you're tasting, it's subjective, and everybody's opinion is right in some way. And he made wine approachable to me, and that word has stuck with me for so long, like that, realizing that's what it was all about, because I don't think I really knew what the wine industry was like and how elitist it can be back then. Like back then I was like, this place is amazing and everybody's going to be like this when I move on and work elsewhere, and it's not.
Well, that's one of the keys, and we'll get to it, just about how, you know, the key for any wine bar is to make it approachable so that you're not intimidating people that are getting nervous. What a great place just for you just to learn. I mean, you went to wine school while also hostessing. I mean, what a wonderful environment to be in.
Yeah, it was amazing. And everybody who worked at that place that has stayed in the industry and moved on still refers to that environment as being one of the most special places that they've worked at.
Yeah.
And they carry that same attitude wherever they go. And like, I go to Edgeless because Toby and Michael run that kitchen, and all of their staff, or 90% of the staff there, are all from Jamie Kinney Wine Bar. There's like this kind of where everybody respected what happened at the wine bar and carried it with them, learned from it and carried with them. And again, it's sort of how I judge everybody. Judge in a nice way everywhere I go to work. Like, is this the environment I want to work in? Is it
sort of set the standard that you'd want to emulate?
Exactly.
Before we continue, you brought over, would you like some bread?
Oh, well, thank you. The service here is lovely.
Well, it's your guys' meat and cheese. I figured I'd bring over. I'm going to bring over the. Where's the best spot? Is there room for it? Or
yeah,
so I want to make sure you can get a little. Oh, there we go. Yeah. This is great pod, by the way. Very visual right now as we're placing a little nice little wooden board of meat and cheese.
Steph, are you going to describe each meat?
No, I'm not going to do that. We're having this.
Do you know what's on this platter, Matt?
Well, we got a hard cheese, a soft cheese. We got some prosciutto.
It's not prosciutto.
I'm not an expert.
You failed already.
Oh, damn it.
So you got the hard cheese. Actually, it's a semi-firm.
Now what sort of approachable place is this? Now I'm feeling intimidated. What do we got here?
Well, I feel like that's something I learned there. You had to know your product. We did everything when we were in that restaurant, and I was a hostess, but I had to run food and I bus tables and stuff like that. But I find that any good restaurant that I go to, obviously you have to know your. You know everything, know your product, know your wine stuff. And when people put down food on a table and are able to go, oh, this is this. I think when I noticed that at the Black Hoof, I always remember thinking they had so many different products, products like meat there, all those cured meats, and the staff having to know it and have it rotate all the time. I was thinking, oh my God, you got to know everything about those products. But that should be what we're getting across the board in the city as far as restaurants go. I mean, I don't need it from Swiss Chalet, but... You know,
we have the white and the dark meat over here.
but like, our Mark makes all of this, or Chef Mark makes them all in house. Not the cheese, obviously.
That would be impressive. Yeah.
Giuseppe, the owner. He's got some cows at home. Yeah. He's milking every day.
Really hate it. He lives three blocks from here. The neighbors cannot stand that smell.
But if somebody's making this stuff in house and doing the work that he puts into it, then we have to know what we're doing in front of house and how to describe it to people and know what's in everything. And we're not always 100% great at it. But
And at any point, if you want to take a bite, I will
I'm more concerned about getting a sip of wine in every once in a while. The wine is more
important.
Oh, no,
no, no. Don't worry on this one. By the way, cheers.
Cheers, by the way.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Before you get back to wine, one meat hot take I wanted to throw by you. I love the Black Hoof. I was so I loved going to that place. Is it wrong that I find bone marrow a little bit overrated? It is good, but I don't know. For me, I don't know. Maybe the price is something. And I love all funky meats and game meats. I love all of it. But I found bone marrow a little overrated.
I think it's funny because I'm going to keep mentioning it. And I don't mean to be obnoxious about it. But I remember Jamie Kennedy had a cookbook from the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
It might have been his first cookbook, only cookbook. I'm not sure. But he had bone marrow in it at the time. And that was like part of like using the whole animal philosophy and things like that. And bone marrow to me is just, it's fat. It's a form of fat that you like to use to moisten other things in your dish. And it's like lardon. It's like me spreading butter on my toast. I'll spread bone marrow on my toast or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's delicious. I think it's great when it's simple, served simple. But after the 80s, or I want to say just as I was getting into JK Wine Bar, is when a lot of chefs were starting to really get into what Jamie had been teaching and some other chefs that were like him. And they were, all these young chefs were coming in and making it like bone marrow, and I'm going to take the whole beast and I'm going to slaughter it. And, you know, and it became like this level of like trendy coolness. And then bone marrow, which they used to be able to either, you could actually go to a butcher shop and get it for free sometimes. You just like, oh, I'll just take the bones. And they were just slicing them and stuff. All of a sudden bone marrow butchers were like selling it, and it wasn't cheap anymore. And then all of a sudden it became like featured dishes on menus. And what something that could have been like a $5 dish was going up to like an $18 dish, and it became elaborate. And I don't know. It's kind of overrated, but I actually love it when it's part of a larger meal, obviously.
Well, I've had it where I love that. I remember one time just eating it right from the bone. I'm like, this is fine. It's not that it's bad, but
it's fat. It's
I love foie gras and stuff like that. All right, so let's skip ahead a couple of years. I feel like we're doing Annette Brulé, This Is Your Life. how much pressure, the first time you were curating in charge of a wine list was at Ascari and Ateca. On Queen East?
Yes.
Yeah, on the south side of Queen East there. Did you feel any pressure when you first took that over? I mean, what would take me to that moment when, you know, now it's like, okay, here's your list, go.
I felt a little, Svetlana Acheva, who was my mentor there, and when she left, somebody else took the list over for a little bit, and then I took it over. She was really supportive of me, and I probably should have been more stressed out than I was. The list was really focused on wines that I had only been familiar with working with her, that whole minimal intervention, kind of not mainstream kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's when changes in the city were starting to happen with wine selections overall. But I felt a pressure to maintain what she had started, but she supported me through it. So I wasn't as stressed as I could have been, I think. And you know what? I think there's a lot of people in this industry who were really supportive at the time. When I didn't understand something, I always had somebody to call who would help me, which was amazing. There was massive amount of support. It was either the wine agent that I was, or agents that I was working with, or coworkers in the industry, or Svetlana was always available to me. So I never felt like I was sinking or failing at anything. And it wasn't long before I sort of found a rhythm in it. So I felt really good about it. And I did feel an obligation to make sure I held up the standards that she had built. But it kind of flowed easily. I feel like within a year, I felt really comfortable.
Yeah.
Just kept growing and growing. So.
And a lot of that just, you know, the work you had done before at Jamie, you were building up to the success. Your confidence was earned.
Yeah,
I mean that's earned confidence. How important is it, because wine is so humbling? And the moment you think you got a grasp of it, well, here's 75 new grapes for you to learn. How important is mentorship in this biz?
I think it's huge. A lot of people spend a lot of time studying, taking their courses, like sommeliers, getting their sommelier certification, working really hard. People that have been doing it for a long time, and even with their studies, know that a massive part of what you learn and what you catalog in your head is due to tasting and tasting with your peers. And a lot of these people spend a lot of their personal time just doing that, like getting together with friends and groups and having a good time, but sharing with each other what they've got in their cellars and tasting and tasting and tasting and tasting and tasting.
Yeah.
Because it's literally what's going to, you can only be taught so much in those courses. And then the rest is just you going out and learning amongst your peers.
Mm-hmm.
It's invaluable. Kind of forget where you started with that question.
No, that was it. That was it. And at some point we'll talk about Svetlana and Pearl Morset, which is one of the best wineries in Ontario. My favorite Cab Franc comes from there. I think that
their
right
Cuvée
now,
Madeleines.
Like I believe in like the idea of like the wrestling. You know, you got the championship belt, and it can change every year.
Yeah.
But I think right now the Cab Franc championship belt in Ontario, you know, it's being worn right now by Pearl Morset.
Oh.
But let's talk about this place. It's we've been chatting now for about 20 minutes. By the way, at any point, if you want a little cheese and meat, you let me know.
I'm leading up to it.
Yeah, you let me know, and then I'll just I'll just gas back. I will just trust me. I come from radio.
We'll pull over the kitchen.
Yeah,
Jenny, maybe.
Yeah. Get them all to come over here.
Say hi.
What's Annette like as a boss? You know.
No, let's not do that.
Yeah. what's the wine philosophy here at Midfield on Dundas West? You see, I added a couple extra words to get you so you could swallow
the wine.
What are you drinking, by the way?
I've chose a really reasonably priced Charolo from Spain, obviously, and it is Montruby. I'm probably saying that wrong. I'm sure there's a lovely Spanish accent.
Grape right, though. You're right there. Good job.
And it's from Bespoke Wine Agency. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's just nice. It's like when they deliver something at a price point that's quite, I don't want to say it's low, but it's like for it, the wine basically delivers more than you're expecting.
Yeah, it over delivers for the price point.
Yeah.
So what's the wine philosophy here?
So currently, it's actually really great. It's a great job to have because everything we buy is got to be like, it's either organic, biodynamic, minimal intervention, natural wines. But it's a wine bar, and so there's other classic selections in here that I can like fit in that from old school producers who wouldn't refer to themselves in any of those ways at all. Mm-hmm. They've just been making wine forever. And so, you know, there's nothing unusual about them. They're just beautiful wines. So I get to like, basically the philosophy is to make sure we have a big selection of all of this stuff and have a large selection by the glass so that people can come in and chill out and drink. We'll find whatever they're looking for, or we can suggest whatever we want, and to make sure it's constantly rotating so that they come back and they have a new experience every time, and that they trust us.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I think when they opened here, it was one of the first kind of real wine bar, and Christopher Seeley and Giuseppe were partners here, and they started out with a smaller list, and I think Christopher's selection was a little more classical, but not really. He was still exposing varietals at the time that not a lot of other people were carrying. So I think the agenda's always been provide wine drinkers and cultivate wine drinkers by showing them new things that they haven't tried before beyond what people are used to, which was like California cabs and super Tuscans and
yeah.
Chianti and, you know, Merlot and safe things that they...
The usual.
I see that everywhere. So
just playing the hits. Okay, yeah. Which is where I want to go to one question. And please feel free to be as political with your answer as everyone else who I've asked this goddamn question to. But my biggest pet peeve is when a place says we're a wine bar and they basically have 4 to 5 reds, 4 to 5 whites by the glass, 1 rosé and a bad Prosecco. And it's usually the same hits. And then you go back 6 months later, and it's the same list. Like, I feel that you should have your title taken away. Like, you can't be called a wine bar. You can be called a bar or a restaurant. And that is one of my biggest pet peeves. How do you feel about that? Because your place
is... It's all about democracy here in Toronto. I don't know. I think that... you know, it was funny because when I was working for Enoteca Sociale, and then I also worked for... Ascari Enoteca. Enoteca literally means wine. Well, it means like wine library or something, but it means a wine bar. But in fact, both those places, we were restaurants.
Yeah.
And And it was always one of the people who were like, I don't understand. And Enoteca was this word that they just thought it was the name of this restaurant. But Enoteca Sociale had an extensive wine list at the time. We built an extensive wine list at Ascari, and it was important for us at Ascari to refer to ourselves in that way. And while we weren't technically a traditional wine bar like Midfields was when they opened it, it was something we wanted people to focus on. The example you gave, though, I mean, no, you're not a wine bar.
Yeah.
And if you're not, even if you had only five and five and five or something.
But you changed it all the time.
You change it all the time. Then great, call yourself a wine bar. But if it's a stagnant list and there's nothing going on, I don't understand where the idea came from. Is people want people to perceive them in a certain way, and they choose naming conventions that they think suit that need and whatever. Yeah. Do whatever you want. But I mean, hopefully the consumer is wiser, buyer beware kind of thing. Like, if you think you're going to a wine bar and your first experience there is pretty lame, then you know better and you know what to look for next time. So
yeah,
your research.
If there's two New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs, a Pinot Grigio and a Sonoma Chardonnay, you're not and this is not me trying to be snobby. It's just, that's fine. If that's your list and the people like it and you make a profit off it,
yep.
Good. You've got a rent, you got a mortgage, you might have kids. Just don't call yourself a wine bar.
Yeah.
That's all. That's my only thing. It's false advertising. It's like the never-ending story. Yep. Eventually, credits rolled.
Yeah.
You know.
Although, like, at the same time, like I said, people can call them, this industry is that you can do whatever you want. You can call yourself whatever you want. But the consumer is also responsible for themselves too. I find like something, you know, when restaurants become really popular, bars become really popular, they get listed somewhere and then people just start showing up, but they have these expectations that have nothing to do with what that establishment is offering.
Yeah.
Because all they heard was that this place is hot, gotta go to it. And they show up and they're like, what do you mean you don't serve steak? Mm-hmm. Well, we're a pasta bar kind of thing, right? You know, right now we don't have steak. You know, it's like you have to, like, if you're excited about going somewhere new because somebody said it was amazing, get online, look at what they're offering, listen to what they're saying, what kind of verbiage they use, and try to be smart about it. I'm like just going back to it and saying, if you want to call yourself a wine bar, fine. Nobody can actually bring a hammer down and say, sorry, we're stripping you of this title, right?
That's
no governing body here.
I feel there should be. I'd like to be part of that governing body. And I'm going to be the one.
You should probably start a podcast.
Yeah. Like, I'm just like, I want to be like Thanos from the Avengers. I'm going to snap my finger and suddenly all these wine bars are going to, them and their bad Italian Pinot Grigio are going to just suddenly like disappear into dust. So I hate to say it. I'm going to. So now, do you want to take a bite of something, and I can?
Yeah, I'm taking.
Do you want to?
A bite of. I'm going to talk with my mouth full. I'm taking a bite of our delicious lardo.
Oh, pork, try that one.
Salted pork fat. It's really good on the hot toast. I just didn't use the toast though.
No. That's sweet. One thing I like about here behind me, there's, you know, you're selling a Magnum of Langhe Nebbiolo 2017, which is fun. You know, Magnums are fun. I recommend anyone listening, if you're going out to a restaurant and they have Magnums and you're planning with a group to drink two bottles of wine, get a Magnum. It's more fun.
I think it's kind of funny that people don't notice it sometimes. That's where the staff come in and they try to encourage them. One of our staff, Jenny over there, actually last summer, I was like, look, these people are coming in and there's six people and you know that they're here for a good time and they want to drink. And there's like six or eight people and they want to like get into multiple bottles, but you know, like one bottle isn't going to, you're going to pour it out for eight of them and they're only going to get a little bit, and like encourage them to buy. We have Magnums that are expensive. It's not always reasonable, but we also have Magnums that are super cheap and they're delicious wines. And I'm like, get them into a Magnum and then let them blow through the Magnums. Yeah. It makes way more sense for them to purchase in that format. But a lot of people don't think about it. They don't realize Magnum is foreign to them. And you're like, it just means two bottles in one.
Yeah.
That's it. You're going to drink two bottles for sure.
But that goes to the point of just, you know, wine can be intimidating.
Yeah.
And what's your approach? Like, what's your plan of attack for this place to just make wine more fun, less intimidating, more approachable?
There's the staff are key. And what we preach to them is to treat people kindly and no question is stupid, and that they convey that to their tables, so that and they draw it out of people. They're like, hey, like, because a lot of people, God, it's so funny listening to people apologize for their lack of wine knowledge. They're like, why are you apologizing to me? It's like, that's totally cool. You don't know about wine. Amazing. The staff here know a lot about what we're serving on the list, and they have amazing palates, and they spend a lot of time asking people questions about what have you drank before? Did you like that? What do you normally like? I'll find you something like that. And here's a taste, and no judgment, just like friendly, approachable service.
Yeah.
And again, like I said, it's like you want to give that kind of service because you want those people to come back. And then the best feeling is to have people come back and look at the staff and go, what should I drink today?
Yeah.
Because that's what you're trying to look for.
It's almost like they're like the wine life preserver. It's like, oh, yeah. Okay, I remember you. I can hold on to you. Everything's going to be safe and fun. But you're right. It's funny about the apologizing thing because I never, like when I'm out with my friends, I never apologize about not knowing law or accounting or business philosophy or, you know, how to improve our ROI on our second quarter. And now I'm just throwing out words that I think maybe make sense. Like, but I mean, like my background
is... It confused me entirely. Yeah, I was there with you.
My background is sports and wine. Like I don't apologize, but it's true. Or do you ever have this when people come over to your place and they bring wine and they immediately apologize that they're handing it to you or they're pouring you wine? Like, sorry. I'm like, don't say sorry. I mean, as long as it's not Wolf Blast, you don't need to apologize.
I did have a moment once where I was like, I'll drink that Yellowtail. This is like after the Yellowtail years. And I did have a moment of going, this is really difficult to get through.
Yeah. Last bottle of the night, maybe. First to fourth bottle, maybe not.
If it's a gift, you use it.
Yeah. I'm going to read a quote. So if you would like to take a bite of something,
okay.
I'm going to read a quote. And this is all about selling Canadian wine and interview you did in 2015 with Jamie with Good Food Revolution. Quote, I don't encounter the I don't drink Canadian or Ontario wine customers as much as I used to. That attitude based on misconception is still out there. But producers and their reps are doing a great job of improving not only their product, but changing consumers' minds. And they're being more aggressive with our customers, not just the wine directors or sommeliers. So question for you, just that was from 2015. It is now 2019. What is the difference in the past 4 years? I didn't need to add past 4 years. I just said that in case you were still chewing. No. What's the difference between selling wine now versus then? Canadian wine.
Canadian wine. Actually, my personal experience, and I've talked about this with other people, and I don't know how recent their experiences are, but they'll still reference those difficult stories about people with, I don't drink that. My experience now is I very rarely get anybody saying anything about Ontario or Canadian wine.
Really?
And we now have people constantly coming in. Like Pearl Moore said, did a great job at getting the wine out there and marketing and teaching people about their philosophies. And I can put those wines on a list, and I think a lot of other people who have wine lists say the same thing. It's like you put it on, you barely have to sell it.
Yeah.
And then people who really love the wines also love introducing it to people, and that kind of enthusiasm they have over the wines, not just Pearl Merced, but a lot of the Ontario wines that they really love now, their enthusiasm is easily passed on to the customer, and customers are totally into it. So that it's fine. I feel like it's finally starting to like finally flow away.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably still exists in some people. I'm sure there's some old school people who, I don't know, maybe somebody collects, they have a massive cellar and they collect like really traditional high end wines, and they'll still insist that Ontario is not that great. And yet we're still young, regardless.
Yeah.
It's only been 4 years since that last quote. But, there have definitely been some improvements, and I feel like that community alone, just in Ontario, is speaking to one another and they're learning from one another. I just brought in something from New York, from the Finger Lakes. It's a Riesling, and I had asked Svetlana, I'm like, oh, have you tried this before? Because it kind of reminds me of Pearl Moore. And she goes, oh, I think the winemaker visited us 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
So it's all within the same...
Yeah.
It's not the same region, but it's like the same area. People are talking to each other and trying to learn from each other. And that's how our region and our province, or sorry, this area is going to grow, whether it's Prince Edward County or Ontario, the Niagara region. BC is like, I'm like really ignorant when it comes to BC wines. And I'm like thinking, I was like, I need to like check out what they're doing and just for my foundation as well.
Yeah.
But they for a long time had a better reputation than Ontario. So I think it's better. I don't know if my peers would 100% agree, depending on which restaurants they're working in.
Yeah.
I think I'm lucky enough to work in wine bars that's like, if we're serving these natural, funky, kind of quirky, sometimes dirty tasting wines, it's not a hard sell to sell, to like convince somebody to buy a glass of some beautiful Ontario wine.
Yeah. If it's some sort of unfiltered, weird wine or grape you've never heard of, it's going to be easier. So here, try this Prince Edward County Chardonnay.
Yeah.
It's delicious. Do you like Burgundy? Fantastic. Yeah. Here, drink this. And I mean, I was at the Shore Club with a couple friends, and I said, all right, you know, looking at the price, I'm like, let's get the Pearl Marsette Cab Franc. And they loved it. I mean, I was like, it's an easy sell.
I feel like there's people. I feel it like it's. I think it's part of my childhood, like fighting with my brothers and challenging everybody. And where you're like, when people are really adamant about it, they're like, no, it's bad. You're like, let's do some blind tasting.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Really, you really know what you're talking about? Let's try some wines blind. You tell me which one you think is the best here.
I've had that as well, and it's funny. I don't even look at it as a chip on the shoulder. You know how Canadians, we can feel insecure. It's not even that. It's more this is good stuff. Like, I'm going to prove you wrong, and you're going to thank me for it because you're going to like this one more. And great. And all it means is now, next time when you're out somewhere, you got more choice.
Yeah.
You got something else you like.
Yeah.
That, you know, that can't be bad. We talked about the do's, like for people coming in here, customers, ask questions, don't apologize. All the, you know, if you want to go out of your box, fantastic. We'll help you. What are some of the don'ts? And not necessarily just here, but just wine bars or just in general. Is there anything you would tell people, try to avoid doing this?
You mean like from the customer?
Customer. Actually, both. Customer and from both sides, from the restaurant side and from the customer side.
From staffs. I'll start with the staff side. Or I don't think this about wine bars everywhere. Unless you are a wine bar that is, I want to say like industry people really want to nerd out about wine. If they already know, they'll go to a wine bar. Like Josh does this at Archive really well. The staff are really, a lot of them are have studied and stuff. And if somebody who's also studied or studying wants to go there and really geek out and really get technical about wine, the staff can be really good there.
Yeah.
And they can speak to that. But you should always be able to read your customers. If somebody comes in, they have no clue, don't get...
Park it.
You got to speak their language.
Yeah.
You cannot speak over their heads. Talk about the things that you know they want to talk about, which is this going to be... Like, they use words that are normal. They use words that are food references, which is completely appropriate. This is basically food.
Yeah.
But in a liquid form. It's like, if they're like, it's too sour, you're like, that's a high acid wine. They don't want a high acid wine. Respond to that. Just don't, you know, don't like go, well, it is, but it's also blah, 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 as if you're like telling them like, well, they're stupid. They should have liked that wine because it's an amazing wine. Maybe it is. They don't like it. Period. You don't want to, go over their heads because you're not, then you're doing the opposite of what I was talking about earlier, which is we're trying to cultivate a wine drinking culture in Toronto right now because it's still pretty young, and you only just stomp it down when you become patronizing or condescending to people.
Yeah.
From a customer point of view,
you might not have an answer to the customer side because
I do.
Always,
no, okay, I do. Oh, good. Like, be okay. So, don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't think we're trying to rip you off. Don't be worried if I ask you what kind of price range you're looking for. Don't feel like you need to go higher than I'm asking you, because we've got a wide range of stuff here and like price range included. If you are here for a $10 glass of wine, I'll get you a delicious $10 glass of wine. If you're here for like a cheap bottle of wine because you just want to hang out with your friend and not really think about it, I'll find you that bottle. Don't be afraid to say... to ask us for what you're looking for. Also, trust the staff. Don't ask for 10 tasters. I was like, a taster is like close to an ounce. We're happy to do it. Once you go beyond three.
Yeah, now you're just stealing
like,
money.
Well, basically, it's not like they're stealing. They sometimes don't realize it. But I'm like, well, I just poured you 3 ounces of wine. How many more are we going to go into? And by then, you've had a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Like, that's our
it's
our
like
product.
The person like at the ice cream place. You get one or two little scoops after that. Yeah. Pick your ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just think about what you like. And the staff, I trust the staff here, and they're really good about trying to separate what somebody's, work out what somebody's asking for. And I know they make really good decisions about it most of the time. So they're going to find you something you like.
Who are your toughest and easiest customers?
Easiest are the repeats, obviously, because they trust us.
Yeah.
They'll drink almost anything. And they've become really good at communicating. Toughest.
Or like, do you have a story about just even, it doesn't have to be here. It could be at Jamie Kennedy. It could be, at any of the restaurants you've worked at. Because I think like listeners are always curious about sort of the behind the scenes and just, the moments that, most people don't get to see.
You know what? I think maybe, I don't want to say it's tough, but we've had people who flat out denied that what we're serving them is what it is.
Oh.
We were just talking about this the other day. Somebody was insisting that what we were serving them wasn't a skin contact white. Has like a pink tinge to it. It's Pinot Gris, pulls the color from the skin. And they're like, no, this isn't orange wine. And you're like, but orange wine is white grapes fermented on their skins or, orange wine is just a simple term that somebody came up with to easily identify or group something together, categorize something. But it's just a white grape made like a red, like red wine process, basically.
Yeah.
This person was just adamant that's not orange wine. And I was like, I don't know how to speak to somebody like that when they're just flat out. I'm like, let's Google this together, sir. We had the same, somebody did the same thing with a Pet Nat. I'm like, Pet Nat's just a reference. It's Petit Lion Naturel. It's ancestral method. But somebody else has taught them that Pet Nat is, I'm sure the guy was looking for like a funky natural kind of wine. Unfiltered and like a lot of briny fermentation.
It's funny what people
flavors
want
to it. Yeah. And we served them this. So he's like, I would like a Pet Nat. It was something that was on by the glass. He got it, but it was a really clean, nice, beautiful Alsatian Pet Nat with this really fun logo on it. So it looked like what he thought he was getting, but then he insisted it wasn't what it was. And you don't know how to argue with people. You're like, I don't know. Am I going to stand here and try to like educate you on this? Or is this a lost cause?
Yeah.
Completely.
Oh.
And they dismissed the staff and they were just like, we're idiots. And you're like, I don't know what to do. I'm like, is this worth the fight? Probably not. So
last question.
Ignorance.
Last question for you. What are you drinking now? Because we go through phases where certain countries, grapes, blah, blah, blah. Is there anything right now you're really enjoying?
I still want to say I'm really, because I keep going back to it, is I love anything that comes in that has, and it can be from many places, anything that is a light red. Well, okay, I'm sorry. My umbrella statement would be I love sparkling wine and I'll drink all sparkling wine.
Yeah.
And I always go back to it, and I feel like it's probably as a result of the industry you work in, physically working all the time, and you're always looking for something that's just like going to cut all the pastiness in your palate and just refresh you. But reds, anything that's like light and has like flinty minerality in it and is vibrant, and I don't know, it's just always so joyful to me. So things like maybe a little more on the classic side, it would be reds from Mosel reds, Pinot Noirs, German Pinot Noirs, but specifically I think I really like Mosel. Gamays, Beaujolais. Obviously.
Last time I was here, I had a nice crew Beaujolais when we came here.
There are some of them. I mean, Gamay is just fun, and I think it's sort of like for a while it's been the sommelier's grape.
It seems to be, by the way, too, like it's always Riesling. I think still the Riesling is the back pocket for Somms, but I don't know. Maybe it's just anecdotal, but recently it's been just Gamay and Beaujolais seem to be the one.
It's funny because somebody was just tasting one with me today, and he's like, this was going like hotcakes for a while, and all of a sudden we can't move it. And it was a really lovely, we're going just easy, approachable, a lot of the qualities I just talked about. And he's like, we can't move it now. And I said, I think it's because there's so much Gamay in the city that you have to, like, now there's a big competition for it. And because the customers are drinking it.
Yeah.
The passion and that the Psalms are feeling about that grape or the varietals and that region is being passed on to the customers. And now they're all into it. And that's great. It's just funny watching people adjust to what's happening in the industry, the agents and the restaurants and the Psalms and
mid-90s.
How they affect each other. And what else? That was it.
Yeah, no, that's good.
The Gamay. Those are my light reds. I just always go back to them. Anything vibrant and fun, basically.
So promote Midfield. It's Dundas West, North Side. It's a little bit east of Dufferin. Just in terms of the geography of this place, but your hours, websites, phone numbers, addresses, anything you'd like to promote. Like, I love this place. I've been here a whole bunch of times. Here.
Thank you, Matt.
Archive, Montecito. I'm just trying to think of some of my favorite, like, wine bars and just places to drink in the city. You know, tell people why they should come here.
Well, we're open 7 days a week. We have a really cozy vibe. I just kind of love that all these wine bars are opening because everybody has a different kind of feel to them. Like, everybody's got a standalone kind of identity.
Yeah.
Here, I think Giuseppe was going sort of like a European vibe. It is really warm and cozy at night. 7 days a week. Most of the time we're open at 5 p.m. Saturdays we open at 3. There's always some kind of fun event going on. If you're interested, we have a newsletter that we send out to our customers. Go on our website, sign up.
There's and what like would deals. That website be?
That would be www.midfieldwine.com, Matt.
By the way, www, what is it, 1999? No. Who uses that anymore?
I just felt like being dramatic. What else? I don't know. We're open till midnight or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, depending on the day of the week.
Yeah.
And we change our wine list once a week.
That's so good.
The big book is supposed to be changed once a month. If I'm on top of it, I am not always on top of it. But there's always something new. If you're feeling adventurous and you trust the servers, they'll find you something that's not on a list, which is fun. And then actually our food is amazing, which is when I was hired here, it was something I was hired to do, is to help promote the food. Mark is really talented. He's got like a really great background. And even in the year that I've been here, I've watched his menu improve. And I want to eat here all the time, but people don't think of us as a place to eat all the time. They think of us as a wine bar, and they think about snacks and salumi, like I'm serving you, and oysters and things. And the fries here are amazing. People are addicted to them.
The fries are great.
But the rest of the menu is unique and awesome. And it also changes like once a week, twice a week sometimes. He's constantly rotating it. So it's one of those places you can come every time you come, you're going to have a new experience. But consistently good experience.
There you go. Hey, Annette, really, really appreciate you joining me and taking 45, 50 minutes of your time.
It's been my pleasure. I wasn't doing anything else anyways, Matt.
No, you don't say that. You say I was so busy, but I granted you in this small sliver of time.
I came out. I was like 1 foot in the grave and I pulled it out, got back up, brushed myself off just for you.
Yep.
And I was happy to do it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes. You can find this podcast, rate, review, tell your friends, tell your enemies. And as always, happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.